Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your Owlpost for the week is freshly delivered, and I am just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing. And with me, as she is always, is the sweater to Drea Kaufman. Drea, it is summer in Arizona, but you're wearing a sweater?
Yeah, if anyone knows anything about summer in Arizona, it's that you always have to have a sweater with you because it's freezing inside everywhere and just cooking outside. So you have to like dress in layers in the summer in Arizona as opposed to the winter you do everywhere else. So, I mean, I'm in my home, I'm not going anywhere, but it still can be rather chilly when the AC kicks on to cool the house down.
It's so true. Yeah.
I come prepared.
Well, we're excited to be back this week. We're on Chapter 5, Fallen Warrior. And before we get into that, just want to thank everyone for joining us and that you can, you know, find us wherever you're getting your podcasts. If you're on Apple Podcasts, hit us up with a star rating and review. Make sure you're subscribed and you'll get the show as soon as it drops. You can also find us on Twitter at Join Nerd Party. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TheNerdParty. We're on Instagram at TheNerdParty. And then you've got the entire website, thenerdparty.com, where you can check out all of the shows we're doing here. And there's also a contact section where you can send an email, and that comes to Drea and I, and we get to converse with you that way. So this chapter, obviously, we just pick up right after. I mean, literally the next second is what's happening here. And I'm so glad that she quickly answers the question that the Fallen Warrior isn't Hagrid. Especially as you're reading this for the first time, because you just saw Hedwig die and you're like, oh, snap, she could kill anybody. And I remember reading this for the first time and I had to flip the page because I was like, it can't be Hagrid, not Hagrid. Because all the rumors were that Hagrid was going to die in this book. Yeah. And so, it's not Hagrid. He's okay. Everybody breathe easy.
This is one of the unique things about this book. She doesn't do it very much throughout the series, where she leaves off in a chapter or in a moment and then immediately picks up in the same moment in a different chapter. Because a lot of times she kind of uses her chapter breaks for time to pass or location transitions, things like that. She uses it kind of as a natural pausing point in whatever story she's telling. And this is one of those times where even early on in the book, it's picking up right where it left off. And yeah, I'm super grateful that Hagrid doesn't die, because that's like I think that's everyone's worst nightmare. It's really sad. You just don't want him to leave because he's one of the few people left in Harry's life that is just that it's so intimately tied to him as something that he needs. And I think even near the end of the chapter, he kind of starts listing off all the people that aren't with him anymore. His mom, his dad, Hedwig, Sirius, Dumbledore, right? And so to add Hagrid to that list would just be so incredibly disheartening. And I feel like it would be challenging to keep reading and if she did it that early and told you right out of the gate. Like, I mean, she kind of told us everyone was fair game in the last chapter, so she doesn't really need to keep doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's so interesting for Harry, too, because he is able to find Hagrid, and then he basically just kind of collapses. His scar is throbbing, and the next thing he knows, he wakes up, and he's on some, like, sofa cushions, and Ted Tonks is there. Tonks is Nymphadora's father, and you know, he lets him know it's okay. You're fine. I fixed your broken bones and your tooth and your arm.
I was going to say, I really like that he grew back his tooth already. I'm like, that's fast, man.
Man, that's great.
Like, I bet there's so many people out there who are like, ooh, that would be such an advantage to dental insurance.
Seriously.
I could just grow my tooth back.
I really want a magical dentist now. So
I know, me too.
Somebody start that. I'll be there.
I don't need that. My husband would love that, though.
Yeah, I would, too. I'm with your husband in that. So, and it's really interesting, too, because, you know, Harry's all worried, and he's still kind of groggy, and he's worried about Voldemort. And, you know, I love that, you know, Ted Tonks does such a great job of just kind of really settling Harry down. He's like, no, it's okay. It's okay. You know, we've put protective charms all over this place. There's no way that Voldemort or anyone else can get 100 yards within this house. And we also, you know, with that, we immediately answer the question of why Voldemort just all of a sudden disappeared. Is because Harry and Hagrid had made it through the protective charm for the Order of the Phoenix. And so makes Harry feel better immediately.
Yeah, and I do love what you're calling out here about Ted Tonks and how Mr. Tonks kind of keeps calm and handles this. He can also put the pieces of what's happening together very quickly. And I just love, I'm sitting here thinking about my in-laws who would be, if they were in that situation, who I love to death, but would be the worst people in this situation because everything confuses and panics them. So I'm just imagining them as an alternative to Ted Tonks and how much more of a sitcom that would look like. I just remember reading this chapter and being like, oh, they're so lucky that it's not my in-laws mm-hmm. that are like what the Tonkses are like, right? Which is such a random place to go. But it's just really that appreciation for someone who stays calm, is focused. And even when there's like this minor tiff between Andromeda, so Tonks' mom, and Hagrid, as he kind of pulls his wand on her, he's able to very quickly turn it around and realize, you know, oh, it's nope. We're just worried about our daughter. Calm down. We can't do that. You'll have to send word back. Keep moving, right? And it was very selfless of them as well, because they are worried about their daughter and they don't know what's going on, and they have to still aid, send them on, and hope that they do the right thing and send word back.
Right. So it's so interesting because, like, you get Harry worried that she's Bellatrix because she looks like her, because they're sisters. And Harry goes for his wand and doesn't even have his wand. And she's like, your wand's right here, son. He says, Ted does. And as she moves into the light, her features become much more soft. And Harry's like, okay. But in this heightened tension that they're in, it makes so much sense, you know, for Harry to be very jumpy. I mean, he honestly just came to. And so.
Well, and it's starting to tie. So we talked about it in, I think, the first chapter or the second chapter, where we're actually at Malfoy Manor. And Voldemort is sort of taunting Bellatrix about having, you know, sort of bloodline traitors. Mm-hmm. And she says, you know, that's no sister of ours, blah, blah, blah. And we're getting to see that sister and see what that means and what she looks like, right? And that will continue through this chapter when we hear that Bellatrix comes at Tonks real hard in this battle, and she is out for her. I mean, it ties it all together and shows it adds so much depth to the story. It's not just Voldemort after Harry. Like, there are bloodline feuds happening along with this from one of, I would say, the most savage characters beyond Voldemort, even sometimes mm-hmm. more than Voldemort, honestly.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
She's more emotional than he is. Yeah.
Yeah, no, they truly are. And I think I like the way you're saying it. Like, it just is setting up everything that this book is going to be about, which in many ways, you know, this book becomes kind of a wizarding civil war, you know, like you mm-hmm. have family against family. On different sides. And so I think that's one of the things that makes the series so moving, is how this shows how you can have different people in a family on completely opposite sides of an issue that can actually come to blows in a war. So and what drives that. So it's a really relevant series still, you know. And I love that, you know, they ask what happened to Tonks, and he's like, I don't know, honestly, everything happened so fast, and I promise, though, I will send word to you once we can. And they have a port key there that will lead them over to the burrow. And before they're leaving, though, this moment where, like, we get to kind of process Hedwig's death, because Hagrid's like, where's Hedwig? And, you know, he feels ashamed for crying about it. But, you know, Hagrid just reaches out and he's like, it's okay. Never mind. You know, she had a great old life. And I just, it's such a beautiful little moment for them because, you know, obviously Hedwig was bought for Harry by Hagrid. So it's one of the things that always bonded them was that gift. And we know how much magical creatures mean to Hagrid. But I just love the way that Hagrid tries to comfort Harry because honestly, he knows, I think, there's really nothing he can say to make that pain go away. You know, the same type of pain that Hagrid felt when he thought Buckwheat was going to die, right? Back in the third book. So,
well, and he's probably feeling some of it too, to your point. You know, he has a soft spot for magical creatures, and it's also his connection to Harry, mm-hmm. right? It was the first real thing he could do for Harry where he got to be a part of his life beyond kind of the little baby he left at the doorstep, right? Like, he also gets to experience that. And so, you know, to him, it's probably also something he's going to need to process and grieve over. And he also knows this, like, this isn't quite the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They need to keep moving. They need to stay strong. It's not the time to dig in real deep to that, right? Like, we got to keep going. We don't know what's going on. There's so many things. So, you know, it's almost like it's a nice moment because it allows Harry to be, it shows that Harry's allowed to be vulnerable right. with Hagrid.
Right.
But it doesn't force us so far off track that we don't keep moving forward and that mm-hmm. Harry can't keep moving forward.
Yeah.
And I do love, it's just true fashion that they almost miss the Porky.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why. I just feel like that moment where they're like talking and not paying attention, it's like, oh crap. And then they have to grab the Porky. Like, I just feel so right.
Yeah.
It just feels it is so very true. Right to their character. Yeah.
Well, and I like, you know, they get back to the Burrow and, you know, Mrs. Weasley and Ginny come running out and they're like, what? They're asking him all these questions about what happened and where is everybody? And he's like, wait, what? Nobody else is back yet? And then Harry kind of goes into explaining what happened. And I really like the way that Rowling just explains this idea that's going on in Harry's head, that as he's telling her what happened and how the Death Eaters showed up and everybody went, you know, their own ways, like he hears himself using this self-justifying tone, you know, just basically like, I'm so, like, he feels so responsible because obviously everybody's doing this for him. And she just gives him a big hug of saying, you know, it's okay. I'm glad you're okay. And thank goodness you're okay. And Harry's like, I don't even know if I deserve this hug you're giving me inside. Like, he just feels so awful for the position that everybody's in right now. And of course, this is Harry. So now, of course, he's worried about all of these people that put their lives on the line. And he doesn't know if they're okay either.
It's true to his character. He always hates when other people sacrifice for himself and for him, right? And this moment, I think he loses sight of what he represents and what he is to this group, which we're kind of reminded of as people start to arrive and Kingsley challenges Lupin as to what the final words Dumbledore said to them were, right? It's kind of like a little subtle reminder to them that, or to us as readers, as to the true sort of importance of Harry. But yeah, I actually really appreciate that when Mrs. Weasley goes back inside to get the brandy. Yeah, mm-hmm. the brandy for Hagrid, that when he turns to Ginny, she literally doesn't need any prompting. She just gives him very like factual, like, here's what's happening. Here's the deal. Here's what we don't know. Here's who's supposed to arrive. And in the order, like, she's very detailed in her information. He doesn't even have to ask. She doesn't judge. She's like the perfect right-hand man. She's that perfect partner you need who knows what you need and you don't have to ask for it. And it's just very seamless. And I think that's just so important to highlight because we talk a lot about their relationship and how it's kind of grown. But even after they've sort of broken up, right, this bond doesn't just magically go away, right? This
right.
unspoken connection doesn't just dissipate. And I think that's a huge comfort to Harry, is to remove that emotional component and get that information in a very straightforward way, even though she very much so has a lot of skin in this game. All of her brothers, her dad are all still out there. Her best friend, right? Her future sister-in-law. I mean, there's like everyone is out there. And so, you know, she has every right to be emotional right now, but instead she remains calm and cool. And I think that's just a true testament to Ginny's character and how she doesn't get enough credit throughout the series.
I wholeheartedly agree. You know, I think I love the way, like you said, that she just immediately jumps into the sit rep. You know, this is what's going down. This is what was supposed to happen. This was what hasn't happened. And, you know, they're immediately, you know, honestly interrupted because Harry gets most of it. And then Lupin and George arrive and George is hurt. And so they're taking him into the house. And it's really interesting. We see our first inclination. You talked about, you know, Kingsley and Lupin doing this. But you get Lupin challenging Harry on who he is and asking him a question that only he would know the answer to, because they have to make sure that everyone is who they say they are, because they realize nobody should have known about this, and so they're thinking there's a traitor in their midst. Because nobody should have known this plan. It's awful because, you know, we have this conversation with Lupin about how did they know it was me? And, you know, Harry's like, how did they know it was me? And Harry tells him about, you know, the fact that, you know, he went to disarm Stan, and Lupin's like, Harry, the time for disarming people is ended. Like, if you're going to like shoot somebody with your wand, you need to stun them. Harry's like, what am I supposed to do? Stan's probably been in Pirrhiast and he's flying through the sky. If I stun him, he falls off his broom. That's as good as just killing him anyway. Like, so they have this philosophical argument, which I think is really interesting. And Harry comes down and says, look, I'm not going to blast people to get out of my way just because they're there. That's Voldemort's job. And so we really see Harry honestly kind of struggling with the idea of this war. Like, you know, and the frustration of it. So, you know, I appreciate, you know, Harry's dedication to not wanting to hurt people. But at the same time, you know, the words of Albus Dumbledore, the last words he ever spoke to Kingsley and to Lupin were, Harry is the best hope we have. And Harry's still, I think, somewhat struggling with that idea when it comes to this idea of, I need to survive.
Mm-hmm. I think it's so interesting, though. I mean, I think there's a whole lot we can unpack there. I mean, he is true to himself, right? He isn't going to change who he is because of that. And I think that this is also the start to some pretty massive tension that starts to build between Harry and Lupin, and will continue to build until it sort of explodes, right? And it's just, it's so fascinating. And I think this is also a turning point for Harry to even speak up, because in this case, he's not asking questions like he did in a previous relationship with Lupin. He's taking a stand and making a decision as to how he's going to be against the better guy, against the guidance of Lupin, better or not, right? Like, they both have points. And it's one of those moments where you can't make that decision for somebody else. They have to make it for themselves. And, you know, it's such a challenge. But I also think we've completely skipped over it, is that Lupin comes back with George.
Yeah.
Who was attacked by Snape and is now missing an ear.
Yes.
That can't be regrown because it was taken off with a curse, which is kind of the first time we've heard about magic being kind of
irreplaceable, is what you're saying?
Yeah, irreplaceable. I guess Bill couldn't also be repaired, sort of way. But this is now the second Weasley son to be sort of mutilated by a Death Eater. And so, you know, they're all lucky he's alive, but man, it's real gross. But of course, George spends no time, wastes no time cracking jokes about being saint-like
Because he's holy.
Hilarious. Because he's holy.
And I love that, you know, when Kingsley and Hermione get back and they're kind of finishing the story, and the fact that, you know, and this is something I dislike that the movies did, is that they made all the Death Eaters be able to fly, because in this one, it's a big deal that Voldemort can fly without anything else, you know? And so they kind of took away something that's really special about Voldemort in the story. They learn that, you know, this is the point where they learn that it's Snape that cut off his ear, and that he always had Sectum Sempra,
an affinity
for that spell. So I really love too here, this is one of the places where this book immediately capitalizes off of that whole, you know, Half-Blood Prince book and the idea of Sectum Sempra, and I think it does a great job of that. And
I will say that one of the few annoying things, and it's super minor here, it's real. It's exactly what would happen when this situation happened, but we get the same story recanted three or four times to get a little piece of information out of each of them, which again, totally reality, but made me kind of skim some of those pieces of the writing, because I'm like, oh yeah, no, we've already heard this. We don't need to hear it all over again. Did you know he can fly? Yes, we know. Four times now. We know. Thank you. Got it. So I would be very unhelpful in that situation. I would be like, whatever, I'm annoyed. But yeah, I mean, that's just one of those little things about the way when you have all these people come together piece by piece, you kind of have to do that. Otherwise, you just assume they all know the same thing. Everyone makes it back piece by piece, except for one duo does not come back. And that's when we learn who the fallen warrior and the name of the chapter is actually speaking to.
Yeah. Well, and before we get there, I love when we finally get Mr. Weasley returning, because he barges into the house and like he is throwing Kingsley off and he is yelling. And one of the things we know about Mr. Weasley is he's so happy-go-lucky. But Harry even mentions in his own mind, like, he has never heard Mr. Weasley so upset. And it's a great moment, because this is, I think, one of the places where it does a really good job here of showing the tension of the moment and how big of a moment this is. That, yeah, Mr. Weasley is literally yelling at people that he normally wouldn't yell at. And
well, not just that, but he lets his better judgment pass him, right? He says, I'll tell you who I am once I see my kids,
right?
Which is a huge security gap, and he should validate himself before, because you never know, right? That's the whole point of why they're doing it. And so he's so just distraught and angry that he's willing to risk the security of what's happening to see his family,
right?
Which tells you it's huge.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. I do like when Ron and Tonks get back too, because Tonks is praising the wonderful service that Ron did her by stunning all these Death Eaters and keeping them safe. And I love that Hermione's like, wait, you did? And my favorite line from the series is when Ron's like, always the tone of surprise.
I know. I do love that. I do love that. Because we've come to know Ron as a fairly apt fighter. We've got no reason to really doubt him. But every time she does, she's like, are we really? He did? You're like, yes, Hermione.
You're like, stop being a jerk, Hermione. Yeah. Ron's good at things. Well, and I think...
But that's also when the moment where we learn about Bellatrix coming at Tonks, right? That it's also... you know, Bellatrix that he's kind of fighting off, who's sort of bigwig, right? You know, he may not have actually done much damage to her, but to be able to defend Tonks against her is, you know, is huge. He's not just fighting off a random Death Eater, which he also did, but, you know, he's also protecting her from the one we've already referred to as very savage, right? Like, he's coming after her family and things like that. So, I mean, her accolades are definitely well-deserved.
Absolutely. You know, it is at this point we get, you know, Bill and Fleur coming back, and they let everybody know that it was Mad-Eye that has died, and you know, that Mad-Eye was actually attacked, him and Mundungus, by Voldemort first, and Mundungus had disapparated, and Voldemort just gave it to Mad-Eye straight in the face with a curse, and he fell off his broom and he's died. It's a really sad moment, because, you know, everybody just has to kind of stop. And I love this moment that Bill walks over to the cupboard there at the house. He pulls out the fire whiskey, he pulls out some glasses, and he gives, you know, some to everyone.
They just start drinking.
But it's a beautiful toast, you know, to this, their fallen comrade. And I think it's a really beautiful moment, because everybody, even the kids, they get to be a part of that. And it kind of, it's like their initiation almost, right? Like, they're kind of adults at this point. They are part of this fight now, whether their parents would want them to be or not. You know, we've had one sacrifice an ear, we've, you know, all of them have almost died, and now it's time to mourn their losses. And I think it's really beautiful. I thought it was interesting too, because, you know, they have the conversation of whether it's Mundungus who did this, and Bill's like, I don't know why he would. He's the one who gave us this idea. He postulates that it's basically, you know, Mad-Eye knew exactly what was going to happen. Voldemort was going to go after the most experienced Aurors first, and that's exactly what he did. He went after Mad-Eye, and then he immediately went after Kingsley. And so,
I was just going to say that too. Like, this is that, you know, I like that they call it out that, you know, Mad-Eye knew he was going to likely be the best target, right? Like, he took Mundungus, who he knew was reluctant. Like, he's not dumb. He was very, very smart. He knew exactly what he was getting himself into. And it was almost like a very willing sacrifice, right? Like, he was willing to paint that target on his back so that everyone else there could get away.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's beautiful too, because Harry, he stands up and he says, look, I don't believe anybody here did this on purpose. If somebody slipped up, I'm not blaming them. He's like, we've got to trust each other, and I don't think anybody in this room would sell me out to Voldemort. And
well, and I love that he says that, because he's thinking about mm-hmm. the very first book when Hagrid trades information about the school and the traps yep. that were set up by the teachers for the dragon egg. And I love that he looks at Hagrid and he's like, there's no way he would do that on purpose. There's no way anybody in this room would do that on purpose. So, and basically, if we spend our whole time looking for a witch hunt, we're going to lose. It's going to detract from the purpose and the point of why we're here.
Right.
And that's what we need to focus on. Let's just move on. It's sad, but we don't need to point blame, which is so hard. It's mm-hmm. so hard to ask people to not find a way to place blame, because that's how a lot of people rationalize and justify and process things, is they have to understand who's to blame, because yep. they have to direct their emotions somewhere. So it's a big thing he's asking them to do. And I do love that Bill, I think, is the one that stands up and immediately has his back before anybody else can poke any holes in his theory, and is like, you know what, that sounds good, let's do that.
Right. Well, this is the moment where some more tension enters the relationship for Harry and Lupin, because he's looking at Lupin, he's like, you have this kind of odd expression on your face, you think I'm a fool, don't you? And he said, no, I just think you're like James. And he would have regarded it as the highest dishonor to mistrust his friends. And Harry knew exactly what he's talking about, this idea of that, like, he put his trust in Peter Pettigrew, and that led to their deaths. But
that was his undoing, yeah. right? Like, that was the fatal flaw right. in his dad. But I think that's the moment where he knows he's willing to accept the same flaw, because mm-hmm. he'd yeah. rather go out as a good person who trusted and loved his friends than a paranoid, angry Voldemort-like yep. person who you know, stuns people in air, even though he knows they'll kill him. You know, like, there's just some very fundamental differences between, you know, his core being and what Lupin is mm-hmm. doing and justifying in order to make it through the war. And I mean, it takes all kinds, right? If
right.
everyone was like Harry, then there would be no war, because no one would do anything. And if everyone was like Lupin, you just don't have any counterbalance to keep the you don't have any counterbalance to remember why you're there, what you're doing this for, and who you truly are. So, I mean, I think it's the natural tension that has to exist on the good side, if you will, of a war. But I mean, it's the same in our lives. We should encourage that kind of conflict because we should be able to work through it and know that those people make us better, both sides. So, but yeah, I mean, it does. It does. The tension keeps growing. And I think Bill steps up and kind of cuts it out and they decide to move on. And I think it's, is it Bill and Lupin who mm-hmm. leave to yes. go and try to find and retrieve Mad-Eye's body? And I love the way that they address the question when Harry says, well, like, why are we doing that? Like, he's dead already. They're like, do you really want him with the Death Eaters? To indicate that they're going to do something very disrespectful
right.
with their dead. And Harry just kind of quietly says, you know, just lets him go. So, and then has his own emotional outburst back to very true to Harry's self, basically freaks out that all these people are risking themselves for him.
Well, and it's, I think it's really understandable here that Harry's like, I got to get out of here. You know, I can't be at this place and let people, you know, take the fall for me. Look how many people have already gotten hurt because of him, right? Like he is very worried about that. And I like the way that they're able to talk him down in that, you know, Mrs. Weasley comes in and she says, look, it's okay. There are dozens of houses that we have set up with the same protection, and there's no way for Voldemort to know which one you're at. And regardless, he's not getting in, you know, so it's okay. And I love how it, like, Harry gets frustrated, right, with this, but it's a frustration because he can't protect them, right? And he can't make them do what he wants them to do, which is to let him go. So there's this double frustration in him that he knows he can't protect them, and he also can't make them obey him. So
Harry's not a patient person.
No, he's not.
Like, he's not a patient person at all. He knows, we know what his role is. He knows what his role is, but he is so impatient that he can't let things run their course because he wants to do something now. And that's exactly what he's running into. And it's the fact that, you know, he's lost so much and he just kind of can't. It's that thing where, like, you know, we're all pretty good about keeping our emotions under control and our, you know, we don't snap at people and stuff like that until we're like hungry or tired or something like that. It's the same for him. Like, he's emotionally drained and tired and he just sort of loses grasp of his ability to remain patient and calm and kind of throws like a Harry tantrum and storms out essentially of the burrow and kind of takes a walk along the lake and then kind of gives in to his scar as well, which has been hurting him since his confrontation with Voldemort.
Yeah. I think it's so interesting because the other thing that makes him really mad, that makes him completely storm out, is because Hermione being Hermione, when he tells the story about his wand, you know, and what happened, she gets all on her basically Hermione horse and like, oh, that's not possible. It was probably you did it. And Mrs. Weasley even kind of gets into it as well about, oh, you know, like kids can do magic, you know, when they're kids and, you know, things happen that they can't explain. And Harry knows what he knows, right? And this is one of those places where you would think that after all of these years with Harry and all of the things that he's told them that are right, that they would just believe him. You know, like, seriously, all the things that Harry's done and had happened to him that people thought were kind of insane, but then ended up being true. Like, why does nobody believe this poor boy at this point? I don't understand.
I agree to an extent. I mean, I think that this wasn't the time or place to have this conversation, right? Like, this was a heightened moment for everybody and everyone's exhausted and everyone kind of went back to the thing that's easy to do, right? Which is to find an explanation and kind of not extend some faith and some you know, some trust. Mm-hmm. And I think if they'd had this when everyone was able to be a little more calm and less emotional, and that maybe they could have actually gotten to some sort of resolution. But I mean, we don't know much about the magic happening here. And I think that, you know, Harry also didn't really give him a break, right? He didn't also say like, you're right, let's, you know, he could have easily let it go. He could have easily sort of been like, yeah, you know, that's definitely possible. I want, and kind of looked at it more and thought about it more, but he just was so spent that he just sort of snapped. Yeah. It's one of those things where I don't know that it's ever super clearly explained what even happened with the wand. I think you have to infer a lot of things as we get near the end of the book as to what happened, because we still don't really even know what's going on here. And that's how it sort of enters into, that's actually kind of what triggers this, the scar and him letting Voldemort in, is it's kind of all around this topic of the wand.
Yeah, this is a really interesting moment, because Harry is able to see what's going on with Voldemort, and he is torturing Ollivander, who apparently told him that another wand would work, and that, you know, he's so mad, he's saying that, you know, you were trying to help Potter escape me, and Ollivander is like, I didn't try to do anything. I genuinely
have no idea what you're talking about.
Which is awful, because, and luckily, as he goes to torture Ollivander, Harry is able to kind of come to, and that's when Ron and Hermione are there. And they tell him, you know, we don't think you should leave. We think you should stay. He tells them about everything that he just saw. And Hermione kind of throws a Hermione fit, like, you know, Dumbledore told you not to let Voldemort into your mind. He told, you know, you that he wanted you to close your mind. You know, he has everything. He's got the ministry, the newspapers, the wizarding world. You can't let him inside of your head. And I can really understand, you know, I think Hermione does have a good and interesting point there, because we don't completely understand this. But I can also understand Harry, you know, at this point, I don't even think this is on purpose, right? Harry's in such an emotional, vulnerable place at this moment. It just kind of happens to him. And we have seen beforehand as well, Harry doesn't necessarily have a ton of control. The only thing that we've seen that allows Harry to have any control so far is the moment where he was able to keep Voldemort from continuing to possess him in the fifth book. And that was because of his thoughts about his friends and love. And so in this moment, when Harry is distraught, frustrated, hurt, mad, angry, like there's none of that here. And so it makes complete sense that this is what happens. And so, but it also does give us an interesting clue that Voldemort is after a wand that will allow him to kill Harry Potter. And he's the one then who we learned in the last book that Ollivander had his shop was gone and boarded up.
He was gone from his shop.
And so now we know why, because Voldemort has mm-hmm. him, which is actually pretty terrifying.
Yeah, for sure. The whole thing is interesting. And I do love to your point when you were making about Hermione and saying, oh, he's got all these things, is I think it also, you know, she talks a lot throughout these books, and we've highlighted a lot of instances where she talks about like media and journalism and the messaging. And I think this is kind of her way too of talking about the amount of consumption of all of that, right? Like Harry, he's got all of the ways you get information dominated already. Do you really want him also just in your head? Like, do you really want that level of toxicity penetrating all the time? Like, it's already emotionally challenging enough to process everything. Do you really want that, like, cherry on the crap sundae too, right? Like, I think there's a point there. You know, we talk about that social media is such a great thing, and you know, we obviously encourage you guys to use it with us and stuff too, but there's also, you know, a point where you get overwhelmed and there's so much and you have to take a break and you need to step back. And I think, you know, that's part of it too, right? Like, you know, he may give you information, but if you burn yourself out, that information's not going to do you any good. So I think she has such an interesting point. She always comes at it from such a different perspective than everyone else. And they very much so end just on that note about, do you really want him in your head?
Mm-hmm.
And you're left with that thought at the end of this chapter that kind of lingers, and you say, well, do I really want him in my head? Because, you know, my answer would be no.
Yeah. I say no to Voldemort inside my head. So I come down.
I say no to anybody inside my head, to be perfectly honest.
It's true. But yes, unless I'm at a therapist, and then I'm there for that reason. So, but that's, like you said, that's the end of the chapter. The next chapter is the ghoul in the pajamas. So we'll get to that next week. And I'm, you know, whew, man, talk about a roller coaster of emotion this week with everything that happened. But Drea, where can people find you if they want to catch up with you?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at PCFcheck or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's Kaufman.
And then you could find me on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero under the name MattRushing02. I'm here on the network doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills as we're talking about Star Wars each and every week. You can also find me on the Trek FM network. I'm doing two shows. One is called The Orb with Chris Jones. We talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine when we can. And then I'm doing the 602 Club, which is our general geek show where we're talking about all the fandoms we love. But thank you so much for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.